And welcome to National Treasure Hunt, the podcast where the secret lies not only with Charlotte, but also with your co-hosts. I'm Aubrey.
And I'm Emily.
And we have for you today our first historical deep dive episode of season 8.
Woo! How did we get this far in the season without doing a historical deep dive episode?
I don't know, because this is really kind of what started us on the National Treasure Hunt journey. So I'm very glad that we're back to it today. In case you didn't read the title of this episode before clicking play, today we will be diving into the history of an historical figure. An historical figure featured prominently in National Treasure Edge of History on Disney Plus, and that figure is Malinche.
I mean, you hear the name, you know the name. It's all over Edge of History. It's honestly, it's been all over our coverage in season 7. So I really think it's about time that we really take a kind of in-depth look.
Yeah, this is definitely overdue. But before we start the show in earnest, Emily, you know what I gotta do? I've got to ask you to kick things off with our screams from Parkington Lane. All right, Em, how has National Treasure infiltrated your life recently?
So I've actually been holding on to this one for a couple months.
Wow.
Yeah, but I went to an escape room.
I'm
Yeah,
sorry.
Which is...
I'm sorry. You went to an escape room? Why do I feel like that would be the worst thing ever for your anxiety?
I did get very anxious before it began, but I was with a lot of friends, people that I'm very comfortable with who have seen me anxious, and then there were some like people that I didn't know. But yeah, it was for my friend's birthday, and so we all went and did an escape room together. And I don't even remember what the escape room was called specifically, but it basically, like, you started in this really small room that had like vines on the wall and like kind of like brick looking things. And before I knew it, there was like a secret door opening into a larger room that then basically looked like it was straight out of Edge of History in terms of like all the symbols and everything we had to put together. It was so much fun. And it was literally just like it felt like Edge of History. I said to Josh like 5 times, like, this feels like Edge of History.
Like the opening day, present day scene of them in the escape room.
Well, no, because it
What?
wasn't in a jail.
Okay, that I thought was the connection you were going to make. Like, you
No.
were like Jess and the team. You were
No,
doing an
it
escape
felt
room.
Like the end of Edge of History, like when they're on, like, you know, looking
Oh
for
my
all
God.
the clues and stuff. It was just very like it had a very like Aztec Mayan feel, and it was really cool and it was fun. So go check out the escape room in the Lehigh Valley. I'm sure there's more than one. And yeah, if
We
you
are
want a good
not
time,
sponsored by them, but we could be.
we could be.
If they want to listen to this and hit us up.
What about you, Aubrey?
Well, I am doing my classic conversion of this segment from screams from Parkington Lane into dreams from Parkington Lane. I have another dream to share. This happened last week. It was a dream in which it was one of those very realistic dreams where you feel like there's not anything totally crazy or outlandish about it. It's not like there are pigs flying in the sky or anything. It was very realistic. And I had a dream that I was a professor at a university of sorts, and I was teaching a seminar style class on current events, issues, and special topics using Nicolas Cage's filmography as like the backbone of this class. This is one of the very rare instances of a dream where I remembered the details, and it had turned out that my I don't know, coursework plans were in depth enough in this dream that I actually woke up and was like, I need to write this down. Like, not that I had the dream, but what the dream was of, because I genuinely now want to create this class. In the dream, I was teaching things like democracy through the lens of national treasure. It was like arms control issues through the lens of Lord of War. Like it was that level of detail. I got up, I wrote it down, I went back to bed, much to my surprise and delight when I woke up in the morning. It was not gibberish. So, keep your eyes peeled for one day when I have free time, the development of said course.
Who will teach said course?
Me.
Where? Are
Wherever I want.
you gonna be a teacher?
Maybe for a semester if it suits me. That's
Okay.
how I roll, Emily.
Okay, that's very cool. So if you would like Aubrey as your teacher, you can go ahead and find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We're also available at nthuntpodcast.com. You can go ahead and order our book, National Treasure Hunt, One Step Short of Crazy, at tuckerdspress.com. And if you would like to join us in more fun times, you can become a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast.
Don't forget, everyone, on that Patreon, you'll get all sorts of bonus content. It's a good time. Okay, Emily, are you ready to talk Malinche today?
Yes.
Okay, gosh, that sounded very aggressive. What we're gonna do, we're gonna start, as always, by reminding Emily of why Malinche is relevant to National Treasure, because we don't trust that she remembers.
I mean, fair.
Then we are going to actually do the history lesson. Who was Malinche? Did she actually exist? What is her story? And then we're going to do the latter third of the episode, is what we're all here for, which is edge of history versus actual history. How do the two compare? What does the show get right? What is embellished? What is strategically left out? And that will be our conversation today. So, Emily, when I say edge of history and Malinche in the same sentence, what comes to mind for you? Are there particular scenes? Are there particular plot points?
Wasn't there a big picture or
You're gonna
painting?
have to, oh, a painting. Oh, in the treasure chamber?
Yeah, of her.
That is correct, yes.
Cool. The Jess's mom's thesis had to do with Malinche, which was really controversial. Yeah.
That's what we got. That's
That's
not
what we got.
bad. I am a little surprised that the first thing you said was there was a painting on the wall. That seems like a level of detail that we wouldn't normally get from you, but I'm here for
I'm artsy.
it. So for all of our listeners who maybe have only watched Edge of History once, or maybe you haven't watched Edge of History, I think you'll still get something from this episode. I'm going to start by giving you the actual rundown of how Malinche is relevant to the story, just so everyone's on the same page. So, the first time we actually hear of Malinche in the show is the second thing that came to mind for you, Emily. This is the context of Manuela Valenzuela's dissertation. This happens at the beginning of episode 3, in case anyone wants to revisit and kind of watch along. But ultimately, what did Manuela say? What was the thesis, really, of her thesis? What? Well, I don't.
The thesis of her
Well,
thesis.
in rewatching this scene, I've got to say, having undergone thesis defenses, I guess we'll say, in our own personal experiences. She was giving the thesis sentence. She was not actually giving a de dissertation defense.
That's true. Everybody was really mean, though.
Right. Okay. So what she said to elicit this meanness, if you will, she claimed that before the Europeans arrived in the Americas, during the colonization period, independent tribes existed all throughout the Americas, and they used arts and textiles to preserve their culture. In war times, Manuela said that some of these women would take their artifacts, basically their culture, and they would leave their communities, So that their history would be preserved, so that the culture didn't get destroyed during war. And over time, quote unquote, their treasure grew, their treasure being these elements of arts and culture. According to Manuela's version of history, one woman risked her life to save the treasure from the conquistadors, and this was Malinche. Manuela asserts that Malinche was an enslaved teenager who was forced to work for Hernan Cortez as a translator. Over 200 years, basically the 200 years that followed the Hernan Cortez's expedition and violent takeover of these various civilizations, Malinche's name ended up being dragged through the mud for helping the Spanish and helping Cortez. But according to this story in Edge of History, Malinche used her position as translator to keep tabs on the Spanish while all of these women effectively smuggled the treasure away. And once the treasure was hidden, the women created a map, broke it into three boxes, gave one to the Mayans, one to the Aztecs, one to the Inca, and then once the conquistadors were gone, the goal was for the women to come back together, rejoin the map, find the treasure. That's the story. Of course, the boxes were then lost over time. So that's actually the story. Interestingly enough, this was surprising to me when I revisited this. Malinche is obviously at the center of this,
Yeah.
but it's like about so much more than her.
Yeah, she's. I feel like maybe the Edge of History writer slash Manuela want her to be the protagonist of this story, but to me, and this was true when I watched it as well, I feel like the protagonists were the women who, like, broke the map into three boxes and that kind of thing. Like that's what felt really important.
But that it's interesting because the ones who make Malinche the protagonist, so I really like that choice of words, were the professors, the ones you said were being mean. So Manuela is giving this presentation to a committee of a few male professors. This is also in episode three. One of the men says that her dissertation is wrong because the Incan and Mesoamerican civilizations never communicated. But more importantly, it's wrong because Malinche was a traitor or, quote, at best, a powerless victim.
Okay, so first of all, rude. Second of all, like, during a dissertation defense, like, you don't need both of those points to come up in your critique of it. Like, make it one or the other. Like, it doesn't, like, saying that it was wrong because the Incan and the Mesoamerican civilizations never communicated, like, to me, like, that would wipe it clean. You don't need to. Take Malinche and, into it as well. I don't know. That's just my perspective. Anyway.
Okay, well, I appreciate your perspective. I was just going to say that this format of a thesis defense is highly irregular. I mean, was anyone advising her? How did she get to the point of
Yes.
defending this thesis if
Yes.
everyone, presumably including whoever she was working under, didn't believe her?
Yes. And this is something I have noticed in, like, treasure hunt movies and whatnot across the board is even if it's not like a thesis defense, but like some type of like larger scale like presentation, presumably where you have an advisor, in some capacity. Like there is in real life, there's a step there where it's like you're checked before you go and present this work to other people. Otherwise, you're just being set up to fail.
Well, everyone, Emily has strong feelings about this that we did not illuminate, as it turns out, on a previous episode. So I'm very glad that we had the opportunity to do so here. Regardless, this isn't the only time we hear the prevailing academic view as presented by Edge of History. At the beginning of episode four, we also very quickly see Jess take a video call with presumably a different academic, I guess.
I mean, if it was an old white man,
Okay.
might still be the same.
Emily, These are for the first time ever, your assumption that the academic is an old white man is not right because this is happening at universities in Mexico. So at best,
Was
we
it an old
have
man?
middle age, I think.
Okay. He
Yeah.
might have. Okay.
Okay. Anyway, this academic assures Jess that there is no way Malinche knew how to read or write, nor that she could have learned to read and write. Why is this relevant? Recall that somehow between episodes 3 and 4, the Scooby Gang comes to the conclusion that Malinche had a secret diary. And to this day, we do not know why they believed that or came to that conclusion in between episodes in context that we did not see. That is one of my pet peeves. Last bit of Edge of History context here. What finding the treasure, quote unquote, proved about Malinche in the context of this show? Recall in back in episode 3, during the dissertation, Raphael was in the audience. The academics are attacking his wife. He runs up to the front of the room next to her and basically says, "Manuela and I, we will find the treasure, and that is how we will prove the legend is real." And then in episode 10, Emily, you're seen where you see the Malinche painting in the treasure room. When the group sees the Malinche banner on the wall, someone, I don't remember who, says, and I quote, "Your mom was right about everything." I agree, just for the record, I agree that finding the treasure means the legend of the women hiding and protecting the treasure was real. It is still very unclear to me how or why this confirms Malinche was keeping tabs on the Spanish while the women smuggled the treasure away.
Yeah, I feel like you could take her out of it and still have the same thing. So I'm gonna assume that this is the writers of the show of Edge of History. It's their way of bringing in this kind of like potentially his I'm assuming historical figure into this story in a way that like might not be necessary, but is like national treasure-esque.
That's exactly right, Emily, and that'll lead us really well into the actual history here. What is real and what is fake? But one thing I do want to say before diving into that, you mentioned this is national treasure-esque, and I think that's a perfect characterization of how Malinche is invoked in Edge of History, because what is National Treasure's shtick? It's not just taking a person or an item in history and giving it a wildly different story. It's taking an object or a person or an event in history, telling at least some portion of its real history, and then finding the one element that's still up for debate. Historians still aren't sure, or people don't fully agree, and taking that one element and turning it like a key.
Yeah.
And that's where you insert your fiction. That is exactly what they've done here with
Oh,
Malinche.
cool. I'm excited.
Yes. Okay. Are you ready for your history lesson today?
Yes, Professor.
I thank you. I need to practice for my Nicolas Cage seminar.
Oh my
Jeez.
gosh.
Very invested. Or Sinus College, hire me for a seminar course. Anyway, when I started my research here, I was really surprised to find, just anecdotally, that a lot of articles started popping up online about Malinche, or La Malinche, as she will be more typically known in historical records, around the period of 2019 to 2021, which is very recent, but not post Edge of History. Because a part of me was like, oh, did people beat us to the punch? Did people see Edge of History and then like write the article? The answer is no, because these articles came out before Edge of History, coinciding with an exhibit, like a museum exhibit, that did a multiple museum tour across the American Southwest in this time period. So this actually, I doubt this is fully a coincidence. I feel like this exhibit probably made Malinche kind of top of the search bar if you will, when researchers were working on Edge of History and looking for historical tidbits to invoke that were Mesoamerican.
Yeah, that's probably right.
A question that we can add to our perpetually long list of things we could eventually ask the Wibberleys. So, who was Malinche? Well, her original name, I guess you could say birth name, was Malinal. Depending on what source you're reading, there are slight differences in spelling and pronunciation. I'm just kind of picking one and going with it, just for the record. So she was born Malinal, but she went by other names in the historical record, including Malensan, Doña Marina, or eventually La Malinche, especially during her time with the Spanish. So a lot of different versions of this story get told.
Interesting. I feel like this is a good place for National Treasure to kind of step in.
Yeah, I mean it does invite the National Treasure treatment, especially because so little information about her is known concretely. Most of what we think we know about Malinche is based on descriptions of her that show up in writings. And those writings are typically secondhand accounts. So it's not like we have Hernan Cortez's journals with long descriptions of who Malinche was. Of all of Cortez's journals, there are only a few references to Malinche at all, which will be surprising after I tell you a bit more of her story. So we're talking like some of, let's say, Cortez's men obviously met and knew and worked with Malinche, and they're telling someone else about her, and that person writes it down. That's kind of what we're working with here. So a little whisper down the laney, and so our detail is lacking.
Okay, I mean, details lacking seem to be a good place for Edge of History to step in.
Absolutely. Okay, so Malinche was likely born around the year 1500 on the Yucatan Peninsula, around Veracruz-ish, like modern Veracruz. She was the daughter of an Aztec chief, which is why, ultimately, compared to many young women, she was pretty well educated. It turns out, though, that her father died when she was pretty young. And what happens to her next, again, the details of what happens to her next are contested. One version of the story is that she was sold into slavery by her mother.
Oh.
Yeah, the reason, one of the reasons I saw was that she had the mother was like effectively remarried, and there was some like inheritance concerns, and so she basically wanted Malinche out of the picture. One account that I saw said that the mother created like a fake funeral to explain Malinche's disappearance. I will caveat this by saying I only saw that in one source, so I'm really not sure.
Okay.
But then another interpretation of the story is that Malinche was actually kidnapped and then became enslaved.
As sad as that is, I do like that interpretation better.
Well, interestingly enough, this piece, like remember this bullet, if you will, because when it comes down to our determination later of can we make an assessment of whether she was a traitor or a victim, to go back to the academics' words and Edge of History, we're going to draw on this point of what happened to her as a kid. Okay.
Okay.
But ultimately, we know that she becomes enslaved. That is not contested. Ultimately, slave traders sell her to a Mayan chief in Tabasco, Mexico. And this is where Hernan Cortez finds her in 1519, when this Mayan chief gave Cortez a group of around 20 young women as servants following a brief conflict.
So, like, conflict in the way of he, Cortez, like, came out on top and his, like,
Yes.
payment was 20 women.
Yes, exactly.
Lovely. Sounds like a stand-up fella.
Very, very lovely indeed. But frankly, a tale as old as time in terms of this time period in conquests of the Americas, as unfortunate as that is. I just want to add a note here that these women were baptized by the Spanish, and this is where, when I said one of her names in history books is Doña Marina, that's where the Marina came from.
Lovely. So not only are we enslaving people, but we're now forcing them into a religion that is possibly not theirs.
Tale as old as time. Great. So by the time Cortez had come along, La Malinche was actually fluent in two languages. She's bilingual. Okay. She's bilingual. One of her languages is her native Aztec language of Nahuatl. And she's also fluent in the Mayan language of Yucatec. Cortez notices this.
Course.
Yeah, he notices this pretty immediately, and therefore he taps Malinche to be his key translator. You can imagine how this would be really beneficial as he's coming into contact with all of these Aztec and/or Mayan civilizations. So initially, Malinche works alongside of a priest named Geronimo de Aguilar, and he also spoke Yucatec. So basically, what would happen is, let's say the Spanish group comes in contact with an Aztec tribe. Aztec tribal leader speaks to Malinche and Nahuatl. Malinche translates that to Geronimo de Aguilar in Yucatec, and then Geronimo de Aguilar translates from Yucatec to Spanish to Cortez and the crew.
Ah, okay. So this is kind of like Sacagawea vibes in a way.
Which ends up being one of the reasons Jess and crew get really confused, right? Because they think Malinche must be the twin-tongued serpent, but it ends up being Sacagawea.
So
That's a
I'm assuming at some point in this process to presumably make herself, I hate to use the term, more useful, but like, I, more valuable in the sense of like she wouldn't just be cast aside. She did La Malinche learn Spanish?
She did.
Okay.
She does. At some point, she also learned Spanish, and now she can be the sole translator. It makes her completely indispensable. And that indispensability ends up extending beyond just the basic practice of translation. She turns into effectively a strategist. It is said, of course, based on these secondhand accounts, it is said that she becomes somewhat of a strategist for Cortez. She helps him forge political connections with the different tribes. She serves as ultimately an advisor and somewhat of a negotiator, especially when you're the person interfacing between two groups.
So, question, and maybe we'll get to this, but if one of the issues that, professor in Edge of History, right, had with Malinche was that she was a traitor, presumably the people La Malinche is speaking to in order to make these kind of like political connections, basically for Cortez, are not viewing her in a treasonous way.
Yeah, I mean that's a really good point. It's impossible to know because we don't know how much coercion is involved in this situation. Like, are the tribes like gotta go with something here so that we're not annihilated by these Europeans and their weapons? It's hard to say. But that's a really interesting point.
Okay.
That's perhaps worth considering near the end of this conversation as well. So, yeah, in this role, Malinche ends up applying her knowledge of like local political dynamics and local cultures. And she actually appears in like every drawing and painting and like pictorial record that exists of Cortez communicating with indigenous leadership. So, that's like actually one of the reasons we know that she actually existed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not just like making up some person.
Right. And not only that, there are some where she's sort of in the background, kind of behind Cortez. There are apparently some paintings or drawings as well where she is shown actually talking and being the one facilitating the conversation. So, I will note that there is a scholar in this field named Cordelia Candelaria, and this person has noted in research at least two instances in which Malinche effectively saved Cortez and the Spanish.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of these is an instance where Malinche uses all of these skills and all of this knowledge to effectively uncover a conspiracy against Cortez by an indigenous group. So a group is going to kind of backstab.
I could see that saving being considered treasonous.
And then, and similarly, but there's a buzzword name in this one. She also discovers a forthcoming attack by Montezuma. And so, in each of these cases, Cortez is able to act first.
Okay. I'll see this. Yeah, this confuses me
Oh, this
in
confuses
how I
you because
feel.
you might agree with the old men professors, question mark?
I'm not ready to say that.
Okay, fair, fair. You are a very thoughtful person. You need the full story. So
Thank you.
let me continue. Ultimately, Malinche participated in all the major events of Cortez's conquest across Mexico through the year 1521, basically the fall of Tenochtitlan, that the big event, which basically ended the Aztec Empire.
Okay.
So basically, either directly or indirectly due to her help, Cortez ends the Aztec Empire, her own empire, if you want to think of it that way, since she is of Aztec descent. The story gets even more complex, though, because she is also well known to have been Cortez's mistress.
Oh.
Yeah, so it's very important to recall, however, she was an enslaved woman, right? And so there's like no evidence at all. Again, the evidence is already so sparse that it's probably not surprising that there's no evidence either way to indicate like she loved him or that she was even willing to fulfill this particular role. It's therefore, I want to make that point because a lot of people over time have criticized her for this. That's probably very unfair. Like, let's think of her actions as a translator and strategist in a completely different lens than as Cortez's mistress.
Well, yeah, and I mean, this might be a personal thing, but I tend to associate the term mistress with like almost like a woman that society expects you to look down upon because they're not the main choice, but also it's putting some blame on the woman. And so the use of the term mistress in this kind of like historical or these historical records just I think underlie this strong sense of like a patriarchy. It because like you said, she's like I would not classify, even if she was willingly doing this, I don't know that because of the whole like enslaved component, we would necessarily want to refer to her as a mistress, as much as like a sexual partner.
Yeah, I mean, you can absolutely say that. It is important to note that Cortez does have a wife back home in Europe, which is, I think, part of where the term mistress is coming from, because it's also typically used in that context. Like you said, it's not the first person, it's someone else on the side. But you're exactly right. We have no reason to believe that she was willingly a part of this. But whether she was or not, she does end up giving birth to Cortez's son Martin in 1522. And now it's worth noting that this is often where the story ends in all of the articles and the records that we see, as conflicting or unsure as they might be. And it's certainly where Edge of History ended the story of Malinche, right? But there is more, albeit It is somehow even less well documented than the first part of her life, and there are even more questions, but we do know a little, or we at least know what people think might have happened. Okay. So in 1524, 2 years after the birth of Martin, Malinche will accompany Cortez as an interpreter to basically modern day Honduras. And later that same year, she ends up getting married to one of Cortez's captains, Juan Jaramillo. Jaramillo was a Hidalgo, or basically Spanish nobility. And one of the things that goes around in these records is this assertion that Cortez probably arranged this marriage for her because his own wife was planning to arrive soon to the New World.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, so ultimately, we do also know that she has Jaramillo's child as well. She has a daughter named Maria in 1526. And ultimately, she becomes known in history, in a lot of culture, as the quote unquote mother of the mestizo race due to her central role in basically opening up a generation of individuals who are of mixed Spanish and indigenous descent.
Interesting.
Yeah, because Cortez is so important, we know about his son, right? Like, I don't think that Martin necessarily, we should assume he was the first person born of this descent, but
Right.
because her Cortez is so such an important quote unquote figure, and there are records of him, like Martin is probably like the first one we have a really good record of, and that is how this moniker comes to be.
Okay.
Ultimately, we, being the historical community, think that Malinche was probably around 29 years old when she died, possibly of smallpox. However, big discrepancy here. Some accounts have her death closer to the year 1550, which would make her around 50 years old.
Wow, maybe there was another fake funeral.
Yeah, I love that full circle moment. But Emily, that is the story of Malinche.
Wow, okay. That's a lot of information to process.
It's a lot and a little at the same time, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of suppositions. And then a little like, oh yeah, this definitely was a thing. I feel like, and this might have been me overstepping the outline, but I feel like we already started to make some connections with Edge of History. So do you feel ready to dive into kind of the like comparing the two?
I do. And I think it's really, to start this, I think it's particularly interesting because ultimately, Edge of History's portrayal of Malinche can be separated into two parts. There's the historical part where they assert that she's part of this network of women saving this treasure. And then there's the modern day part, which is the professor's interpretation of her as a historical figure. It turns out that the interpretation that the professors have in Edge of History, this idea that Malinche was somewhere between a traitor and a victim, is actually a fairly accurate description of the complexity of how Malinche is regarded in real life today. So the professors, in a weird way, if like Riley is the audience stand-in in National Treasure, the professors are kind and the fake professors here are kind of a stand-in for probably many real professors, if you will.
I mean, that's super fair because I think even just hearing that story, right? I am conflicted.
Yeah.
So, like, it makes sense that other people would be too. I mean, not saying that
Absolutely.
I'm the be all end all of people, but.
No, that's exactly right. On the spectrum of traitor, victim, survivor, different people have different opinions regarding where Malinche falls to this day. Let's take a little bit of a look at how public perception has treated her over time. I would say, interestingly, but perhaps not surprisingly, public opinion against Malinche was firmly established after Mexico won its independence from Spain. Which, think about it, it makes sense, right? Mexico begins defining its own history, defining its own culture. And as it's doing so as an independent country, it's probably going to start looking at its own history through the lens of contempt for the conquistadors and therefore also the people who helped them.
Yeah, that's just like that's some revision, not revisionist history isn't the right word, but like
No.
way to pull out that one, you know, at a ripe time.
Well, I mean, this actually reminded me a lot when I was doing this research of some research for a separate project that I was doing recently, where I learned that the lost colonists of Roanoke, not actually lost. We the SparkNotes version is it's pretty well regarded that they assimilated with other with like local Native American tribes. And so the turning of the opinion and people started changing the narrative to lost colonists happened around the time of the Trail of Tears, when we were told, we being like the President Jackson and important people in the United States were creating awful situations for Native Americans, and public opinion just could not accept that, you know, colonists would choose to assimilate with and build culture with Native Americans.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry. Total sidebar, but I found that so fascinating, and I think very similar here.
Yeah. Damn. Okay. Sorry.
Did I
Yeah.
break you? Did I break your brain?
A little. Can you tell?
Yes, I can. Well, it is interesting, though, I think, to hear this context because it also does make sense, I think, in terms of the timing of this public opinion development. And I do want to point out there's a Mexican slang term, and I apologize if I mispronounce this, Malinchista, which is apparently used to describe a person who is, quote, and I'm quoting this from Smithsonian Magazine, disloyal to their country, or who abandons their own culture for another.
Wow.
So when you look at that term and its definition, it kind of makes sense that that would arise as a definition, as a concept around the time of Mexico gaining its independence from Spain.
Yeah, I mean, all of this is just feeling like very, like there's a very clear narrative that those in power want to put forward, and yeah, like it doesn't matter until it can be used in a political way, you know, like this history doesn't matter until.
That's an interesting interpretation because I feel like that's a little extreme for this case. It's not
Okay.
like we have a government saying we hate her now, per se. It's more of a broader cultural phenomenon or movement, where people are like, this person is the reason that our ancestors were viciously killed, for example, and therefore we don't like her. And we can say that now because the people who killed our ancestors are gone.
Okay.
That's how I
Fair, fair.
think of
Yeah,
it.
no, I think that's good. And I think it's cool that we have different, you know, just like initial interpretations of this, you know.
And the other thing I want to say here is an unintentional National Treasure franchise connection that comes to mind for me is Samuel Mudd, right?
Oh.
Bec
As soon as you said mud in the beginning,
drag through
I
the
had
mud.
that thought.
Yeah, well, you know that's why they literally use the phrase drag through the mud in the dissertation defense.
Oh, I didn't think about that, but that
Okay.
makes sense.
Yes. But the broader connection here isn't just the quote. It's, you know, whatever, even as our collective public perception of Malinche, different people might change their opinions over time, new contexts shed new light. It doesn't matter. You know, the fact that this Malinchista term exists, that will not go away. It will always exist, kind of like the his name is Mud
Yep.
expression.
Whether or not it's okay, deep stuff.
Deep stuff. Okay. So the other thing that I want to point out is that Candelaria, that scholar that I mentioned earlier, admits that Malinche is perhaps unfairly judged by today's standards as opposed to the context of the time in which she lived. This is why I found your question about like the indigenous tribes she was encountering and their perception of her. That's why I found that question, Emily, so interesting because we don't know what their perception was. But regardless, they're operating in a different context then than we are assessing from the year 2024. I think that applies to Candelaria's point here also. As a woman in her society at the time, Malinche's role was to serve, it was to obey. Okay. Not to mention the fact that on top of that cultural context, she was enslaved. It's not like she had free will to work with if she had any desire to survive.
Yeah, true. Yeah, her survival was dependent on her doing what she was told or expected to do.
Exactly. And another piece of, I would say, time period era context that's often missing is that many indigenous groups, again, at that time, the early 1500s, at least upon early contact with Europeans, they were at least some part curious about the Spanish. They, in many cases, welcomed the Spanish to some extent. The Spanish were mysterious to them. So early on, after all, we've covered this on the podcast, Montezuma welcomed the Spanish in at first. So why would we criticize a young woman of engaging with or maybe even trusting them if entire communities, if entire chiefs or chiefdoms were at some point engaging with and or trusting of the Spanish at first?
Because she's a woman.
That's why we're criticizing her. That's exactly right. That's why society is criticizing her. But again, they're also criticizing her because we're in the year 2024 and we look at this and it's like obviously what she did was wrong,
Sure.
but it's not that simple.
No.
And here's one more, Emily. Ready for this? Don't forget, we did explore this previously. It might have been in our Hunt for Facts episode on Edge of History. It was said that Hernan Cortez looked a lot like the Aztec god Quetzalcoatl. Remember, legend says Quetzalcoatl was supposed to return the exact year that Cortez arrived. We talked about this in the past. It was one of the reasons why it was so, like, that it was an interesting historical tidbit that might have explained some of the reasons why some of these Mesoamerican communities were welcoming Cortez in. So I don't know.
Not just her fault.
Right? Could this have played into Malinche's willingness? Did she think that perhaps this was the return of Quetzalcoatl? And if that's her religion, is she responsible for serving her god, Quetzalcoatl? I don't know. I don't know, but it's worth asking.
Oh, 100%. Oh, gosh. I feel like everything is just, it's confusing me more. Like, I
Okay.
don't know how to feel.
Well, Emily, I know you're someone who cares deeply about personal traumas and how personal experiences might impact people's decisions in life. And I don't know why you're giving me that look. Am I wrong?
No, you're
We
correct.
just had a whole conversation about this in the context of your professorship before we started recording.
True, true.
I want to bring up another argument that the scholar Candelaria makes that I think is very interesting. This is going to call back to what I said we need to remember about Malinche's childhood. It is at least possible that Malinche wasn't exactly beaten up about quote unquote turning on her community since she was sold into slavery by her own community, either by her mother or someone else.
So, like, almost like getting back at them.
Perhaps, or maybe just instead of active revenge, it could also have just been a general indifference to the idea. Like, also, it's not like she's going in and like
Yeah,
physically
not
harming
killing,
people.
yeah.
She is serving as a translator and a strategist. I you know, maybe she's indifferent to the effect that she's having on her community because of her past experiences.
And like you do what you need to do to survive, and maybe you feel a little less broken up about it. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So as we start wrapping up this section, which I hope I have just just confused you to the extreme, Emily,
Yeah.
in a good way though, I think it's also worth noting that we can allow ourselves to consider whether we are impressed by Malinche's intellect, even if we don't agree with how it was applied or used. I mean, not only could she fluently speak multiple languages, something that very few women could do at the time in this like civilization, but she could also strategically deploy those languages. Like she could negotiate. That is like next level in terms of comprehension and just intellect in general. And
Yeah.
you know, it's really this intelligence and Malinche's ability to overcome a patriarchal society to survive and thrive as an individual in such a society that leads some people today to look at her as like a model of feminism.
I mean, yeah, I don't. Okay, yeah, I mean, that just that messed me up more. Yeah.
I'm so excited to ask you your like ultimate
I'm scared.
determination. I'm
I'm
so
scared
excited. It's
for it.
coming.
I'm
It's
not
coming.
excited.
Because there's only one more thing we have to
Oh my
say about
gosh.
comparing Edge of History and the history of Malinche. We have to go back to some of the details of the Edge of History story because we would not be National Treasure Hunt if we were not paying attention to all of the details. It is worth noting historical sources do not tell us that Malinche could read or write. Though to be fair, neither does Edge of History, because that was once again a misinterpretation of the twin tongue serpent clue by Jess and Billy. But it was ultimately, as we said before, Sacagawea that was the correct interpretation of
Right.
the clue. And obviously, historical sources do not tie Malinche to a network of women or to a Pan-American treasure or any of that. So the real accuracy that Edge of History has is asserting that Malinche was a translator for Cortez and demonstrating a prevailing belief or opinion regarding how people view her today in the eyes of these professors. All right, it's time to reflect. Emily?
I've been reflecting the whole
Yeah,
time.
I know. Well, I'm going to ask you to put those thoughts into words. What was Malinche? Was she a traitor, a victim, a survivor, or something else?
Is it a cop out to say all of the above, potentially?
I'm going to make you elaborate.
So, like, if you break down any single person, you're gonna get real deep here.
Okay.
If you break down any single person's actions in life to some groups, that person is going to be seen as a traitor. To some groups, that person is going to be seen as a hero, or I guess in like a more modern kind of day terms, like an ally. Some people, you can look at the same story of a singular person, and you can, depending on the angle that you look at it, you can paint them as either a victim or a survivor. And I think there's an inherent kind of seesaw, right, that not only people looking at it from the outside have, but also people, themselves that are in these situations have. And of like some days, they might see themselves as a survivor, and some days they might see themselves as a victim. And I think that if you boil it down to what group is looking at Lumliche at any given time, or even if we want to think about how she's viewing herself, right? I think it encom she encompasses all of these things, and I don't necessarily know that that's a good thing or a bad thing, and I don't know that I feel from like a cultural perspective that I have enough evidence or even like the place to say whether it is a good or a bad thing. But I think that, long story short, everybody has all of these components inside them, and it's about
Based on
who's.
who's interpreting them.
Yeah.
So I'm going to take my interpretation a one step further and say, I think one person can be all of these things, but not just from an external perspective, just based on points in life. And so I feel a little bit more confident in being a little less wishy-washy. I'm going to test a theory on you or test a maybe an interpretation on you. And I'm not necessarily married to this. But yeah, I want to test it. So I kind of think that she's all three of these at different points in her life.
Okay.
I think that she is definitely on the victim end of the spectrum when she is enslaved as a child, whether her mother sells her into slavery or she is kidnapped and sold into slavery, especially the fact that she is a child. In this situation, added to the ultimate outcome of what happens to her, this is where I feel like she most closely aligns with the victim categorization, if we're looking at these three options. I think as she is now, as soon as she starts to serve Cortez, particularly as a translator, especially in those early years when she has to work alongside de Aguilar. As like, so it's very clear she can really only serve in a translating role. This says survivor to me because she is doing what she has to survive. She is an enslaved woman. She is being told by her, her master, I hate that term, to translate, to be a translator. She is translating. She is surviving. I think where you could make the argument that she edges into traitor territory is when she moves from just being a translator to being more of a strategist and a negotiator and someone who's deploying her knowledge, her own knowledge that, to be fair, like Cortez cannot prove that she has, so she can easily like choose not to share this knowledge and he would be none the wiser. She chooses to use her knowledge of political context, cultural context, etc., alongside the translating to be now not just a translator, but a strategist, a negotiator, almost a diplomat of sorts. And that I think could be considered more on the traitorous side because it is clear the outcome, like she is having an outcome because she is negotiating for that outcome. That outcome is bad for the indigenous communities and we don't know whether she cares or not, but she's taking a more active role. So that's where I see her on this spectrum, perhaps, is this evolution. But it's also worth noting that as that evolution happens, she's gaining agency, right? From a child to an adult, and now an adult who actually has some sort of warped power, because it's not real power, she's still enslaved. So, do we feel comfortable in saying that she becomes a traitor once she has full agency over what she's doing? That I'm not sure.
Yeah, I mean, I think labeling someone a traitor is a, it's like a big thing, right?
Well, we're not here to debate the definition. It's just like this is what she is considered by most of society. So that's the word we're going to use. Sub in the synonym that you'd like.
I mean, I agree with the supposition that because, yeah. I don't know if we can actually consider her a traitor at the end of it all, but I'm fascinated by this concept of this like progression through the course of her life that you're putting forward. I really like that. And at first I was very much like, Aubrey's just dissing me because I'm saying like all this like ooh, kind of stuff, and she's gonna make it more clear. But like, actually, that is, yeah. I mean, you're taking, not taking what I said, but you're putting a timeline to things, which I think is a really interesting way of looking at it, especially because we're talking about history.
Yeah, that's our analysis, I suppose. As we continue wrapping up, there were a couple other things I just wanted to note. It is a little unclear to me, but at least one source that I found in my research said that Malinche's marriage to Jaramillo meant that she died a free woman with the rights of a Spanish noblewoman. Again, I don't know if that's true, but we did know that Jaramillo was a Spanish nobleman. If this was true, it's very clear to me why Edge of History didn't like tap this part of her bio, because it really would have made the conclusion that they wanted viewers to draw, namely, Malinche was maligned and ultimately redeemed by the story they created. I feel like if she had died a free noble woman and they brought that to the viewers, it would have made this conclusion they wanted us to come to a little bit less obvious. Like, because I do think that adding to the end of the story that after she did everything that she did, for the people who believe she was a traitor, she ends up kind of winning in the end because she's free and she's legitimate, like all has all these rights that she didn't have before, would feel a little bit stickier. Right? Because maybe we don't, maybe she, maybe Edge of History couldn't say she was quite as maligned as they
Yeah.
want us to feel.
That's a great point.
It could also just be the fact that it's not clear whether this is true. I suspect people who are actual historians could actually tell us the fact of the matter, whether this is accurate or not. Therefore, I believe the Edge of History writers probably had access to that information, but I do think that. We Disney and any writer in any for any company will pick and choose the information from history that they're going to use to suit their story.
That's true.
One other cool thing I found or thought about in the Smithsonian Magazine article, they point out a striking similarity between Malinche and Pocahontas, but they note how the media's portrayal of Pocahontas over the years has contrasted significantly. Right, because we literally have Disney. Disney is a huge part of the reason why we all know Pocahontas' story so well, and they are the reason that her story was romanticized. So, in a weird way, Edge of History kind of gives Malinche the Pocahontas treatment of sorts, just not through a romantic lens, it's through a vindication lens. Think about that. Malinche has, in reality, this very complicated past, this very complicated story that's really hard to figure out where you come out on in terms of your opinion after you hear it. But when you finish the Edge of History story, Malinche is a hero. There are no ifs, ands, or buts about it.
Except that we, kind of got to the end and we're like, well, did you need to be here? But
But that's
yes.
because we are National Treasure Hunt and we are nitpicking and dissecting the story.
Yes, very, very.
But yeah,
I, yeah.
it's kind of in a weird way, Malinche is Disney's 2020s version of Pocahontas, question mark, in terms of taking and kind of co-opting an historical figure and interpreting their story in a way that they want to interpret it. Did I break you again?
Bold.
Did I break you again?
Can you just stop breaking me?
No, this, I was really not sure how this episode was going to go because history episodes, if we're not careful, can accidentally be a little bit dry, but I'm pretty confident in how this one has turned out, if I do say so myself.
I can't. It.
Yeah,
Aubrey, I have too many thoughts. Like, I almost feel like we need like a part two.
well, do you have any? Okay, we are officially wrapping up. We have like
Yeah, yeah,
one
yeah.
more point left. So if there's anything else you would like to say, speak now or forever hold your peace.
History is complicated.
And that is a statement that we can take to the bank. I will just say, to come full circle and to connect back to something that you said earlier, Emily, I think the fact that we, in our history books, in our historical records, know so little about Malinche, it really lends her as a character to something like National Treasure. It is so much easier to add that National Treasure spin when there's some element of mystery or unknown, because you can more easily invite the audience to ask, what if?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, I think it's like it's a perfect storyline.
And that, dear listeners, is the story of Malinche in the context of National Treasure: Edge of History.
I mean, if you liked that and have your mind blown as well, and just want to like contact us on social media with, I guess, like a series of like dot dot dots. Or like the little like mind-blowing emoji, do so, or any thoughts you may have. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at NT Hunt Podcast. We are also available on our website, nthuntpodcast.com, and possibly for more of these types of conversation in a smaller group setting, maybe consider joining our Patreon at patreon.com/nthuntpodcast.
Next episode will be, I think, far less deep, but like in a really fun way. Next week, we are going to be analyzing how much it would cost to conduct a national treasure heist. That is going to be a ball of fun. I am genuinely so excited to not just research, but deliver that episode. And yeah, come back for it. I mean, aren't you curious?
I'm curious and I'm going to be doing part of the research. So, like, I hope you are too. Come back, y'all.
Until then, everyone, I'm Aubrey,
And I'm Emily.
and thank you so much for joining us on our National Treasure Hunt.